Still, we are not saying that this is the most difficult situation. Of course, the war is horrific in what's happening in Gaza. But to make the Israeli society stand up against the war only because of the suffering of the Palestinians, as much as it is moral, I'm afraid it's not enough to make the people in Israel, especially after the 7th October. It's not going to make them stand up against the war. But what is happening in the Israeli society, the fact that more than 150 soldiers have been killed, the fact that they the families are receiving their sons, their soldiers injured and handicapped, is might be more sufficient in convincing the people to go out against the war.
I wanted to ask specifically about the power of the voices of the hostages or their loved ones who are speaking out for them. This is Sharon Calderon speaking last week, sister-in-law of Ofer Calderon, who's being held hostage in Gaza.
We just want them to sit, all the cabinet, we'll sit and we'll find a way to negotiate and to bring our people home. We want them home. But no one is doing nothing right now except fighting. And fighting is not the answer right now. We want our people here, back home, with us. And if we fight, we cannot bring them alive. And we don't want to get bags. We want to get them alive. So this is why we're here every day until we heard from the government that they are sitting, talking.
Now, this is a powerful voice, the families of the hostages. You have on Monday them screaming, shouting in the Knesset as Netanyahu is addressing the Israeli parliament. Achshav, achshav, now, now, demanding that the hostages be released. Already, it's clear that a number of them, not just the three men who were killed by Israeli soldiers, the young hostages, but a number of others were killed in the Israeli bombing in Gaza. The significance of this voice, and if it's being amplified by others, did you expect the hostages to play this kind of role, the hostage families?
Well, of course. I mean, no one can imagine the suffering of people who don't know what is happening with their family members. If I was in their place, I will also be not quiet, and I will do whatever I can in order to change and to bring them back. So, yes, I think it is expected, although they are showing very high, they are very effective in how they organize themselves and how they are very vocal and speaking out and demanding to bring their families. This is also happening, I think, as a contrast to the fact that this government, the Israeli government, is not giving this issue much attention if you compare it to the other targets or goals that Netanyahu put for this war. And that's why they felt neglected. That's why they felt that they don't have the enough backup from the government and they needed to organize themselves and to be so vocal about the issue.
Aida Tuma Suleiman, we only have less than a minute, but you are a Palestinian journalist as well as an MK, a member of the parliament. I wanted to get your response to it. It's believed over 100 journalists and media workers have been killed in Gaza. The headlines today, TV journalist Mohammed Khair al-Din and Ahmed Khair al-Din, the journalist and cameraman, also died in a bombing in Gaza. Your response to the demand, for example, by Al Jazeera for the International Criminal Court to take on the issue of the targeting of journalists?
Well, there are 105 a journalist who has been killed since the beginning of this war. If you remember, it started also by other journalists before who were killed, including Shireen Abu Akleh, who was targeted and killed from Al Jazeera. We have the feeling that the journalists are targeted in order to silence the voices who are coming out from Gaza and exposing the reality of what is happening.
Of course, there should be an investigation.
Of course, there should be an investigation, and it should be a clear out that there is no possibility to continue to be quiet about this targeting.
Aida Tuma Suleiman, we want to thank you so much for being with us, member of the Israeli Knesset, MK, that's a member of the Knesset, Palestinian member, suspended last month for criticizing the Israeli military assault on Gaza, joining us from Akko in northern Israel. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Nermeen Sheikh.
We continue to look at Israel's war on Gaza and turn now to the war's impact on children. According to Palestinian officials, the Israeli assault has killed more than 8,200 children in Gaza over the past 11 weeks. At least 8,600 children have been injured. UNICEF says some 1,000 Palestinian children have had limbs amputated without anesthesia due to the lack of basic medical resources.
We're joined now by Steve Sosby, founder of the Palestine Children's Relief Fund, an organization that provides medical and humanitarian aid to Palestinian children in Gaza and the West Bank. The fund, founded in 1991, has helped build pediatric cancer center units, emergency departments, and ICUs in Gaza. Six Palestinians that the group brought to the United States for free medical care in recent years have been killed in Gaza since October 7th. Two of them killed this week within a day of each other. Izzedine Nawasra was killed on Christmas with his entire family. And Mohammed Al-Ajouri was killed the day after Christmas with his wife and baby. Steve Sosby, our deepest condolences. If you can talk about these two, well, people who were children when you met them, when they were brought to the United States, you brought them to get them medical care, and now killed in the Israeli attacks in Gaza. Tell us about them.
Yeah, well, both of them were amputees. Both had been shot by snipers during the Great Return marches of 2018. They were teenagers who were participating in peaceful protests at the gates. They're at the borders of Gaza. They're refugees. They were born into refugee camps in the Gaza Strip. Their families were descendants of refugees from 1948 when the State of Israel was created, and were, as all refugees in Palestine, demanding the right to return to their villages, to their homes, to their towns within Israel. During these protests, both had suffered below-knee amputations from the result of being shot by a sniper. And our organization, as a humanitarian organization, identifies these kids who need medical care they can't get locally. And the quality of prosthetic care in Gaza before October 7th was really underdeveloped and in need of improvement, which we were working on. So these kids were brought outside for treatment. Izzedine was brought to Harrisburg, Pennsylvania, where he was provided a new leg and taught to walk again. And Mohammed was brought to Dayton, Ohio, where the same thing. Both of them were provided below-knee prosthetics for free. Treated by excellent facilities and also by our communities who took care of them as host families. And they became very much integrated in the communities, part of the communities where people want to be involved more in helping these children. Both of them had great experiences during their treatment. They flourished being outside of Gaza for the first time in their lives. And when we sent them back home, as we do with all of our injured kids, both of them started to have a new hope in life. They, for the first time since their injuries, they were able to go back to school. They were becoming independent. They were mobile. In the case of Izzedine, we even hired him to become a field worker for our organization. And one of the areas that he was quite interested in was photography. And so we gave him the opportunity to learn and to train in photography to become part of our communications team. And he was flourishing. He was, having an opportunity to, it was a dream for him to help his own people. I've been in touch with both of them during the war, the bombings in Gaza, and Izzedine in particular I was quite close with because I had taken him back home after his treatment, and he had mentioned that, you know, he was still alive, because that's the communication you have with people in Gaza these days. It's just a very basic, are you still alive? It's not much else you can really say. I hope you're okay. It's kind of a painful way of expressing your sympathy and support for the people there. And, you know, he was always responding, yes, I'm fine. How are you? And then recently was asking, you know, how can I do more to help my people? I'm looking for ways to be part of, you know, humanitarian work here on the ground during this terrible crisis. So even during this period, a boy who had lost his leg and who was, you know, disabled for the rest of his life in a certain sense, was looking for ways to help his own people during this terrible crisis. And both of them are, as you mentioned, two of six kids that we brought to the United States who've been killed over the past 2.5 months.
So, Steve Sosby, you mentioned, of course, that even before October 7th, the care for amputees in Gaza was very, very poor. If you could talk about what you're hearing from your colleagues in Gaza now, where there are so many children who are in need of prosthetic limbs, what is the situation there now, especially since also, as we reported, you know, there isn't even anesthesia available for operations for children who are so much in need?
Yeah, it's hard to even convey the idea that in this world today that children are being amputated, having limbs amputated as a result of traumatic injury without anesthesia. And by the way, there's plenty of anesthesia medicine at the border of Egypt waiting to enter Gaza. There's plenty of food at the border of Egypt ready to enter Gaza. Children are starving. People are starving in Gaza. It's not as if there's some kind of natural disaster that's preventing anesthesia medicine to come into Gaza and be able to be utilized to treat injured children. This is absolutely unimaginable that this is happening in this modern world. And we're witnessing it, and everybody sees it, and nothing's changing. The fact that there's now 1,000 new amputees, at least, and that number is going to grow because a lot of these kids are with insignificant injuries in which their limbs are going to have to be amputated in the coming weeks and months. Let's keep in mind, not only were they amputated without anesthesia, but many of them were amputated in a very quick fashion. And, you know, God bless the doctors and nurses in the health sector in Gaza. They are the true heroes in this, if there are any heroes in this, and there are, of course, among the Palestinian health workers. They're the ones who are day and night in the hospitals, exhausted as their own families are living under bombs and being killed, trying to help their own patients. And they're doing these amputations in a very quick manner because they have so many injured cases coming in. And a lot of these kids who are suffering traumatic amputations have to have surgery again in the future and even further amputations because they're not getting the adequate care in the initial stages of the amputation. So they're going to need revision surgery. So what we're trying to do is we are identifying these kids, get them out, and get them the treatment they need first and ensuring that they have adequate surgical services, and then fitting them with prosthetics and getting them walking again. There is no services at all in Gaza for amputees. The hundreds of kids that we've treated over the years who've suffered traumatic amputations in Gaza, like Mohammed and Izzedine, who were killed this week, those kids are, their limbs are breaking down. They're being destroyed. They need to be adjusted. They need to be repaired. So these kids are now going again without limbs. And you can imagine under these circumstances, once again, being dependent on others to carry you around or being on crutches, while your neighborhoods are being bombed or your refugee camps are being bombed, is just an unimaginable situation. And this is the reality. There's absolutely no services available for them right now.
Well, on November 25th, during the seven-day truce, Defense for Children Palestine filmed an interview with 12-year-old Dunya, who lost her leg in an Israeli airstrike that killed her whole family. Dunya then was herself killed on December 17th after an Israeli tank-fired shell hit her while she was recovering in Nasser Hospital in Khan Yunus. This is part of her interview with Defense for Children Palestine, which we're playing posthumously.
When they shelled us with the second missile, I woke up and was surrounded by rubble. I realized that my leg had been cut off because there was blood and I had no leg. I tried to move it, but it wouldn't move. My father and mother were martyred, my brother Mohammed and my sister Dalia too. I want someone to take me abroad, to any country, to install a prosthetic leg, to be able to walk like other people. so that I can move and go out and play with my siblings. I want to become a doctor, like those who treat us, so that I can treat other children. I only want one thing, for the war to end.
So that's 12-year-old Dunya, who was killed on December 17th. Steve, if you could talk more broadly about the crisis in medical facilities generally, I mean, even the most basic care that's no longer available to people in Gaza who need it now more than they ever have, and talk also about specifically the cancer hospitals that you've built there.
Yeah, so prior to October 7th, we were on the ground in Gaza identifying needs in all of the various specialties in the health sector and developing programs to support the improvement of patient care and reducing the need for patients to leave the Gaza Strip for medical treatment that they should be getting locally. We were training doctors. We were bringing in medication, medical support. We were bringing in medical teams from all over the world. We're the main organization doing this and providing hands-on training and support in various specialties that don't exist in Gaza, open-heart surgery for children, neurosurgery, orthopedic surgery, and so on and so forth, reconstructive surgery. These were all specialties that we were identifying as a need on the ground and bringing in teams to address those needs. And in addition to that, we're identifying significant gaps in the health sector, like the lack of pediatric cancer treatment for children, in which prior to our opening of the only cancer department in Gaza in 2019, every single child in Gaza with cancer had to travel outside for treatment, and a lot of them were suffering, and in many cases even dying due to the lack of permits being issued or the access to care. After October 7th, the health sector, as you all know, has been almost completely destroyed. There's only a few hospitals now functioning. Most of them in the south, European Gaza Hospital, Nasser Hospital, Al-Aqsa Hospital, are the three main hospitals in the center and in the south of Gaza Strip that are now operating. But they're basically just triage centers. They're doing some CPR there. And this is what needs to be pointed out, as Amy said in the early part of the show when she mentioned the statistics of over 8,000 children in Gaza have been killed. They've been killed by bombings. They've been killed by traumatic injury. What about the children who have heart disease, who need medical care they can't get in Gaza anymore? What about the kids who have neurological disorders or have cancer or have other types of, in many cases, quite serious injuries or diseases that they otherwise would get through our medical teams coming in or through the health system being available that can do elective surgeries, no longer having access to care? Treatment, kids with diabetes, kids with dialysis. All of these children no longer have medical care and they're dying or they're not getting treatment. In many cases, their conditions are getting worse and they're suffering. What about the kids that are now in these internally displaced areas like these UN schools where they're sharing a toilet with 700, 800 people? All these communicable diseases going around within these small communities or these huge communities now of internally displaced people. They're getting sick. They don't have access to primary care. And in some cases, these children are dying. Add to that the fact that significant number of children now in Gaza are suffering from hunger and from starvation. All of these factors, in addition to the over 8,000 children that have been killed through bombings of their homes and of their schools and of their mosques and churches and hospitals, you add all of those numbers up, and it's an absolute humanitarian catastrophe far beyond what anybody can even articulate properly in words. It's unimaginable. Our cancer department, which we opened up in February of 2019, was the first shining symbol of hope in Gaza that we can do something. It was built by our community. It wasn't built by a government. It wasn't built by a foundation. It was built by thousands of people coming together and saying children with cancer in Gaza shouldn't have to go without treatment. And that's the kind of ethos that we believe very strongly in, that you bring the services to them, you develop the services, and these children get treatment near their families with the best care possible. That's destroyed. That hospital has been closed down since November 7th. It was bombed on November 5th. When you hear the words of Dunya, the 12-year-old girl who was killed, God rest her soul, and what she expressed, that she wants to go outside, she wants to walk again, she wants to be a doctor. This is the hope of all the children in Gaza. And what we're going to do, what I'm going to do in the future, is every one of these children needs not only a new leg to walk again and to have their bodies repaired, but they need long-term healing. They need an opportunity to develop themselves into doctors. We have to give them that opportunity. Their lives are being destroyed. Their lives are destroyed, but they want hope for a better future. We have to come together as a community. We have to come together as people who have love in our hearts, not hatred, and serve these children for the long term. Develop programs where kids like Dunya, who's 12 years old without a leg, God rest her soul, have a chance for a better future. We have to take that responsibility. We're going to take that responsibility. That's the only way we can bring peace and healing to the children of Gaza during this nightmare of suffering and death that they're enduring today.
Steve Zoosby, we want to thank you so much for being with us. Again, our condolences. Founder of the Palestine Children's Relief Fund, an organization that provides medical and humanitarian aid to Palestinian children in Gaza. Speaking to us today from Washington, D.C. Coming up, we look at Secretary of State Tony Blinken and the Homeland Security Chief's meeting with the Mexican president in Mexico City yesterday, discussing migration and the border. Back in 20 seconds. Begins to Sway by the Gaza Youth Choir. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Nermeen Sheikh.
Secretary of State Antony Blinken met Wednesday with Mexican President Andres Manuel López Obrador in Mexico City, along with U.S. Homeland Security Secretary Alejandro Mayorkas, to address the record number of people being arrested at the southern U.S. border, as many as 10,000 a day. Officials announced a new joint working group, but shared few specifics. AMLO has blamed U.S. sanctions on Cuba and Venezuela for the rise in migration. Biden eased sanctions on Venezuela's oil and gas industries in October.
As the high-level talks took place, the Associated Press reports Mexico ordered workers in Matamoros to use bulldozers and machetes to clear a border encampment that included families with children who say they were given little notice before their tents were destroyed. Meanwhile, a caravan of some 6,000 migrants from Venezuela, Honduras, El Salvador, and Haiti left southern Mexico on Monday. For more, we go to Mexico City, where we're joined by Laura Carlson with the Mexico City-based think tank MIRA, Feminisms and Democracies. First of all, it's interesting, Laura, that we have really so little information about what came out of the talks yesterday between the Mexican president and the Secretary of State and Secretary of Homeland Security. We understand that they were going to be asking for visas to be withdrawn from people heading north to the border, railways being more regulated, bringing people up from southern Mexico. Talk all about what you understand at this point and why you think we know so little after the meeting.
It is somewhat surprising that so little specific information has come out, because in fact they promised that a joint declaration would be made after the meeting. We still haven't seen that. The meeting really represents the way in which the Biden administration has adopted the Republican framework of immigration as a threat to national security, of migrants as a threat, of border chaos in this pre-electoral period. And that's the tragic meaning of this meeting. It's a delicate issue for both countries, because on the one hand, the Democrats are losing any distinction between their own positions, the Biden position, and the Republican position. We know that reports are out, the negotiations for the funding for Ukraine and Israeli wars is being premised on accepting Republican demands for reducing humanitarian visas in the United States, increasing deportations, and also denying asylum and due process in many ways for a greater number of people who are requesting asylum in the United States. All these measures require cooperation from Mexico. Mexico would have to receive the people who are being rejected, and as a sovereign nation, it has no particular obligation to receive people being thrown out of another country. It would have to facilitate deportation flights. So for President López Obrador, it's a delicate matter because there's issues of national sovereignty. He doesn't want it to look like Mexico is also caving to a Republican model of stopping immigration without looking at the root causes, without looking at the human rights issues that are at the root of so much of this immigration, forced immigration, and at the root of the violations that are taking place on the border. So he doesn't want to come out and say that we've agreed to new contention measures. The U.S. government doesn't really want to do that either. So they're coming out saying there's going to be this regional working group. And this includes Guatemala, it includes South American countries. The fact that there was a dialogue is a plus for Mexico, because in other cases, and oftentimes, it has to simply accept unilateral measures from the United States. And in many ways, it still does. The border closures that happened right before this meeting were a bully move on the part of the United States that has a tremendous impact on trade, not just in Mexico, but also in the U.S., and that reminds the Mexican government of its dependency on the U.S. economy. So now President López Obrador is requesting a in-person meeting with Joe Biden. And that indicates that they did not concede everything that this delegation from the United States wanted, and that they are going to push on some of what Mexico wants to get if it is forced, and it will be, to do the dirty work of the United States under this contention model.
So, Laura, could you talk about some of the root causes that you referred to and the fact that Mexico's president has said that the sanctions, U.S. sanctions against Venezuela and Cuba, are in part responsible for the increased number of migrants attempting to come to the U.S. So if you could explain what do you see as the root causes and what accounts for the increase in the number of migrants attempting to come to the U.S.?
It's so important that Mexico has placed the issue of sanctions on the table in this whole immigration debate, especially now as Republicans are turning it into this xenophobic and really racist rhetoric that we're hearing and that we will continue to hear up to the elections. What we know is that for the first time ever, the last month, Venezuelans surpassed Mexicans in apprehensions at the border. And there's no doubt whatsoever, and there are very deep economic studies that show this, that the reason is because of these blanket economic sanctions on Venezuela. They're punishing people who can no longer feed their families. There's a huge spike in child malnutrition, and no parents are going to sit by and watch their children starve. And so people are forced to migrate. This is a classic case of forced migration, and it's a direct result of U.S. policy. The same is true of this spike that we're seeing, and we can see it here in Mexico by just looking at the composition of these caravans and the flows of migrants coming through from Cuba. The sanctions since the Trump administration that really did not undergo major changes during the Biden administration are causing increased human suffering, and that increased human suffering is leading to increased immigration. So you see U.S. policies at loggerheads, where they are actually causing the migration that they then try to contain through these measures that are whipping up racism and that are also feeding into Republican campaigns. The other reasons are also oftentimes related to longtime U.S. policies. They include the violence in Central American countries, here in Mexico. That's a direct result of this drug war model, the kingpin strategy of fighting violence with violence through militarized forces in these countries and maintaining prohibition in the United States. They also include neoliberal policies.
Well, Laura Carlson, I want to thank you for being with us. We're going to ask you to stay, and we're going to do a post-show interview with you in Spanish and post it online at democracynow.org. Laura Carlson, director of the Mexico City-based think tank MIRA, Feminisms and Democracies. That does it for today's show. On Monday, New Year's Day, we'll bring you a special on Julian Assange, the imprisoned WikiLeaks founder. The High Court of Justice in London will hear what may be Assange's final appeal in February. I'm Amy Goodman with Nermeen Sheikh. Thanks for joining us.
This is CNN.